This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. I am one of your hosts for today, Susan Franzen. Our show today will be about ways to deal with problems in our environment, not how to deal with snow and cold, but other problems. So I'm happy that Local Talk's farm reporter, Gina McAndrews, could be with us. Thanks for joining us, Gina.
Hello, Susan. It's great to be back. It's been a little while, but it sure is always great to join the show. I understand our first guest is Ingrid Grossel Anderson. I think I met her at the Practical Farmers of Iowa conference last weekend. Who else do we have joining us today?
On a related topic, Adam Mason from the Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement will be telling us about a lawsuit suing the state for negligence in protecting our water. Leaving that, we'll hear about an enjoyable winter meeting of the Iowa Prairie Network taking place this coming Saturday. And finally, how to make log furniture from invasive species. I discovered our lead story from the Iowa Capital Dispatch, the nonprofit online news source we heard about last week. And we'll be talking to Ingrid Grossel Anderson, who was mentioned in that. So it was really great to find that story. And thanks to Kathy Obradovich for bringing it to my attention.
Yes, that Iowa Capital Dispatch is a great way to stay informed on some of the things going on in Iowa.
And I believe that we have Ingrid on the line. Is that right, Ingrid?
Yes. Good morning.
Oh. Okay.
Good morning, Ingrid.
Well, I'm glad that you're calling in instead of driving in. I need to introduce you. You are the Water Program Director at the Iowa Environmental Council. Thanks for being with us. I'm so glad that you can give us some idea of what steps are being taken to improve our water quality.
Absolutely, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you.
And have you met Gina, by the way?
Were you at the
PFI conference?
Iowa conference? Yeah.
Yes, I think I met you at the booth there. But I'm sure you met hundreds of people. There was a great crowd there.
Yeah. It's a little hard when you're tabling to remember everybody who's gone through. But, yeah, it was a great crowd, and I was happy with them also considering the weather last weekend.
Can you tell us a little bit about your position at the Iowa Environmental Council and what you're working on?
Sure. So I'm a water program director. So a little background on the Iowa Environmental Council. We are a nonprofit law and advocacy policy organization. So we work primarily on clean water and clean energy, and we're the largest environmental coalition in the state. So we have close to 80 organizational members, and those are other environmental nonprofits. We also have businesses. We have groups like, municipal utilities and public health associations. So we have a pretty large and diverse coalition of interests in Iowa's environment, and we advocate for our members' interests up at the Capitol. So session just started, so we are up at the Capitol talking to legislators and decision makers up there. We also do education and outreach across the state. We're based in Des Moines, but we are a statewide organization, so we work across the state on water quality issues and clean energy issues. And then I'm an attorney by training. We have four attorneys in the office, and we also have policy experts. So we work a lot in the legislation and strategic litigation areas.
So what are some of the issues and policies going on with Iowa's clean water, or working on getting Iowa clean water?
Sure. So one of our biggest concerns in the state with water quality is nutrient pollution. So when we talk about nutrients, we're talking about phosphorus and nitrogen. These are elements that are found in fertilizer, so in both commercial fertilizer and manure applications. And there's also, some background, amounts of this in the soil anyway. If you have healthy soil, it's going to have nutrients in it. That's what allows plants to grow. So it's very good. These are good things for growing plants. That's why we call them nutrients. But the problem is it's a leaky system. So these nutrients can be picked up by water and then enter waterways, and then they become a pollutant And they cause, for instance, algae blooms, harmful algae blooms. So they're good for land plants. They're also good for algae and aquatic plants as well. And you can have algae blooms. And this is one of the biggest problems nationwide is that nutrient pollution causes the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. So you have an area at the mouth of the Mississippi River down in the Gulf of Mexico, and you have an algae bloom, and then it decomposes. That uses up all the oxygen in the water, and then there's no more oxygen left to support life. So this is one of the main problems that we've been trying to address for a couple decades now. Decision makers have known since the 70s that the Gulf hypoxia dead zone was an issue. And the Gulf Hypoxia Task Force was formed back in the late 90s in 1997. And they came out with a few different iterations of an action plan, the most recent of which was in 2008. So that's kind of background on nutrient pollution in general. The state took that on, so all the states in the Mississippi River were tasked with putting together nutrient reduction strategies based on that Gulf Hypoxia Task Force, and Iowa adopted ours back in 2013.
And so what have we done so far?
Well, that's a good question. Part of, you know, our concerns with the nutrient reduction strategy, so when we talk about water pollution, the way the Clean Water Act sets it up, there are point sources of pollution and non-point sources of pollution. So a point source is something you can point to a specific spot at which the pollution is coming out. So traditionally, this is like a wastewater treatment plant or an industrial facility or something that would have a pipe coming out into a waterway. And so you could directly point to where that pollution is coming from. Non-point source is more like your agricultural land, urban stormwater, something where you would have water flowing across the land and it's not coming from a direct source, so it's hard to determine exactly where those pollutants are coming from. So in the nutrient reduction strategy, point sources have regulations on them. They have discharge permitting requirements and other requirements to and standards to control their nutrient loading into Iowa waterways. But any non-point source efforts are completely voluntary under the strategy. One of the challenges with that is that according to the nutrient reduction strategy, 92% of nitrogen and 80% of phosphorus come from non-point sources. So the vast majority of the pollution that we are receiving into Iowa waterways is coming from these non-point sources that only have voluntary measures for reducing water pollution. So the short answer to your question is we haven't gotten very far yet because the implementation rates for those non-point sources have been quite slow to date.
Because there's not really much for an incentive to do so, is there?
There are some programs. So a couple years ago, the state legislature passed a water quality bill that would put in about $282 million toward water quality improvement projects over the next 12 years. But that's still a pretty small amount in the overall, you know, what we would need to implement conservation practices on the ground to mitigate this nutrient pollution. So there are some monetary incentives available to landowners, but there's no, you know, there's no requirements. There's not a big push or any sort of stick to go along with that carrot to increase these implementation rates. And actually, we put out an analysis this past year, looking at implementation rates, and they're actually slowing based on our analysis of the most recent annual progress report of the nutrient reduction strategy. And that makes a lot of sense when you think about a voluntary program. You know, you'd have a lot of people, you'd have a lot of excitement and early adopters jump in at the beginning, and then that tailors off because everyone who's really interested in participating has already participated. And so how, you know, one thing we're thinking about a lot at the council is how do you get that next step of implementation to really try to get at this problem at the scale it needs to be addressed.
I've talked with a few farmers, and being from a farm myself, I have a little understanding when the kind of the farm bills and policies, a lot of them, you know, encourage farmers to maximize every piece of ground to grow all their crops right up to water's edge and ditch's edge. And I've talked to a lot of farmers who did establish some nutrient reduction, you know, in the riparian areas and grass waterways. Hmm. And then they say, well, I look across the stream and, you know, my neighbors aren't doing it. So what difference am I making? So then I might as well just keep doing what I'm doing until there's some regulations that everybody has to do it. What's your thoughts?
That's one of our concerns, actually. You know, I think we are definitely in support of farmers, and we want, you know, we want to support them in doing work like this. And, you know, part of it is an equity issue. You know, if you're a farmer that wants to put in conservation practices at this point with a voluntary structure, that you might be putting that in at your own competitive disadvantage to your neighbor, exactly as you say. And so, you know, we also hear a lot that people want to do the right thing. And I think without regulations or without a baseline understanding of what that right thing is, it's not clear to people what, you know, to farmers, what's expected of them out of this. I think there's not a lot of clear education from policymakers or clear expectations from policymakers. So, you know, we, you know, people are concerned about regulation, and they're, I think, suspicious of regulation, but we actually see it as a way to level the playing field and make sure, you know, everyone has some skin in the game, and at least everyone needs to do something. And that those that can be tailored to individual operations or individual lands, but we would like to see, you know, everyone participate in this, because as you said, you know, one or two landowners in an area, if their neighbor is not taking care of their land in the same way, you know, that's going to be discouraging, and that's going to be at a cost disadvantage, and that's not going to be successful in cleaning up our waterways.
As you mentioned, another source is urban areas and people who put lots of nutrients on their lawns and golf courses. Is there any kind of strategies or incentives for those people to manage their runoff?
Well, I think those would be covered in, you know, there are some regulations of urban, you know, stormwater. There's permitting for municipal stormwater systems. One thing in Iowa, you know, I think that gets brought up a lot, and it's obviously contributes to the problem. But if you think of the amount of land area in Iowa that's covered by, you know, towns, we don't even have, you know, a lot of strictly urban areas in Iowa. But if you know, the land area occupied by towns versus the land area occupied by farmland, again, I think the vast majority of the percentage of this nutrient concentration is coming from those farmlands. So that's the area where we can get the most bang from our buck of addressing the nutrient problem, which is not to say that we wouldn't also, you know, try to incentivize less fertilizer on lawns or less fertilizer on golf courses. That's obviously, especially if you're around areas that have, you know, streams or ponds or lakes going through. One thing that Polk County is doing that's pretty interesting is establishing riparian buffers in their urban areas and establishing ordinances for that. So I think you see the municipalities understanding the importance of maintaining their waterways through town, and I think that can be used as a model on, you know, farm ground as well.
Have there been any increases, like, in policy, or how is our you know, our governor and our state legislature encouraging our clean water or nutrient reduction strategy?
Yeah, so I it was encouraging. The governor included in her condition of the state address funding the Natural Resources Trust Fund which was passed by Iowa voters back in 2010, and that would it would raise the sales tax 0.375 would go toward outdoor recreation and natural resources conservation, and a good percentage of that would go toward water quality projects. So I think that the governor's interest in funding that is hopeful. We continue to push for, you know, stronger criteria for nutrients. Last year, we petitioned the Environmental Protection Commission, which oversees the Department of Natural Resources, asking them to set numeric nutrient criteria for lakes, specifically because, you know, lakes are an important economic driver in the state. There's a public health impact for recreation, and the EPC denied that, largely referencing the nutrient reduction strategy and its, you know, its place as the policy toward nutrient reduction in the state. We're a little concerned about that because it is just a, you know, especially for non-point sources, it is just a suite of practices that farmers can employ, and it's not a standard as set forth under the Clean Water Act. What we were asking is for the state to actually set water quality standards, so we would have these kind of benchmarks to understand exactly where our water is and where we need to go for cleaning up those waters. So that's been a little disappointing, and we are still waiting to see data from the most recent annual report. Usually we would have seen that, a draft of that, as a stakeholder organization back in the fall, and we haven't seen any of that data yet. So we are interested to look at that and update our implementation report and get an idea of where the state is for nutrient pollution.
So they're getting more funding, but who's using this funding then? If it's just a voluntary thing and nobody's using it, why is there need to be more funding and taking it away from other programs?
Right. Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, that's one thing, you know, based on the nutrient reduction strategy, there does need to be, or you know, the assessment that the nutrient reduction strategy did, and there does need to be funding to implement these kind of conservation practices on the ground. And of course, we would look for some sort of carrot and stick approach. So you would obviously want to help farmers with the cost of implementing, you know, wetlands or buffers or that sort of thing, especially in an economic environment like this. But you would also want to have requirements, want to have monitoring. You would want to have accountability for those public funds that are being used on private lands. I think you're exactly right that, you know, we would want to see increased funding, but we want to make sure that funding is properly spent so that we get the most water quality improvements for that public money.
Right. Well, thank you so much for talking with us this morning, and please continue all your great work because we all need our clean water, and especially they do. Yes. Down in the ocean in the Gulf of Mexico.
Absolutely. It's a challenge. There's a lot of smart people working on it in the state, so I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you about it this morning.
Thank you very much. We have to go now.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. We've been talking with Ingrid Grunstahl Anderson, Water Program Director at the Iowa Environmental Council, telling us how the nutrient reduction strategy could address the problems of our polluted waterways. Adam Mason from Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement is here to give us a more aggressive set of actions to address water quality. Thanks for being with us, Adam.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So what is ICCI's approach to improving water quality?
Sure. Well, you know, in the face of inaction on things like the Iowa and Water Land Legacy and having the voluntary nutrient reduction strategy in place, obviously we've seen Iowa's impaired waterways continue to grow in spite of this voluntary approach. So last year in March, Iowa CCI, along with our allies at Food and Water Watch, filed a lawsuit against the state, essentially claiming that they're not doing their job. We believe every Iowan has a right to clean water and that the state has a duty to protect that right, which they're failing to do.
So, and how do you, so what's the status of this?
Yeah, so, you know, of course, the state didn't really like that, the lawsuit. So they filed a motion to dismiss our lawsuit. We had a hearing in court back in June of last year. And in August, a judge issued a ruling agreeing with us that our lawsuit could move forward, agreeing with all the merits of our case, and that this lawsuit should have its day in court. After that, the state filed a very rare appeal to the state Supreme Court to intervene and to review the district court judge's opinion. That motion was granted, and so right now where we stand is our lawsuit will be reviewed by the state Supreme Court sometime this spring. We've kind of been in the process of filing briefs, but beyond this court procedure, we're using this opportunity to try and have the conversation with more Iowans about why water is important to them and how they're impacted by Iowa's degraded water quality.
And so what can these Iowans do? They can lobby their legislature, I suppose. What else can they do?
Yeah, so that's a great point, Susan. You know, right now is the best opportunity we have to interact with our legislators. As we know, you know, this voluntary nutrient reduction strategy is not working. And the fact of the matter is Governor Reynolds has put a proposal out there to try and invest more money into this failed strategy. You know, kind of using a shell game to kind of move some money around to increase sales taxes and roll back income taxes to appear to put a lot more investment into this failed strategy. We think, you know, that ultimately, if we don't do something to stop pollution where it starts, to start changing our farming practices away from the industrialized model back to a regenerative farming model, ultimately any money we put towards water quality is just dumping it down these polluted rivers. So we have to do something to stop pollution at its source. And we know one of the biggest sources of water pollution in Iowa is the factory farm industry. So actually, we're going to be asking people to go to their legislative coffees on the weekends to engage with legislators. We're holding a lobby day tomorrow, Thursday, January 23rd at the state capitol. Folks can join us there to stand with hundreds of other Iowans and put pressure where it really needs to be put on these legislators.
Well, I've heard some things about a moratorium on CAFOs. How does that work?
Yeah, so that's the big push that we're after right now is, with over 10,000 factory farms here in Iowa, 8,000 of those are swine CAFOs. They generate 22 billion gallons of liquid manure that's just dumped on farm fields across the state. We know we've got too many, and it's time to tap the brakes. It's time to stop building more factory farms. We see approximately 400 to 500 new CAFOs every year here in the state. And, of course, they're concentrated in certain areas of the state, like northwest Iowa, north central Iowa, southeast Iowa. But more and more, they continue to expand into areas they previously had. And, you know, last year, there was a big fight in Story County, for instance, with the sighting of 5,000-head CAFOs just outside the city limits of Nevada. So, you know, areas of our state that had been untouched by factory farms are starting to feel the impacts as well. We need a moratorium. That's kind of the first step to stopping the spread of this style of agriculture. It would allow us to change the rules and regulations we need to catch up with the expansion that this industry has had. There hasn't been a significant legal change to permitting for factory farms since 2002. So ultimately this idea has gone from kind of pie in the sky to really catching steam over the last 2.5-3 years. One in four Iowa counties, 26 counties now, have passed resolutions calling on state legislators to act to rein in factory farm permitting, a number of those calling for a moratorium on factory farms. At one point, there were eight candidates in the presidential field. A number of them have dropped out now, but eight candidates in the presidential field that were calling for a moratorium on factory farms, including two out of the four current frontrunners. Senator Bernie Sanders and Senator Warren have called for a moratorium on factory farms. Senator Cory Booker, who recently dropped out, has actually introduced a moratorium bill in the U.S. Congress. So we see the momentum for this growing. I think momentum and time are on our side. We just need to keep putting pressure on decision makers to act.
Can counties do much to slow down or prohibit factory farms, or does it have to come from the state level?
Yeah, currently the way that the Iowa's permitting laws are set up, it really does tie the hands of county supervisors. The final decision on permitting is made by our state, which is a big problem. A number of states, surrounding states like Minnesota, Missouri up until last year, a number of surrounding states have what we call local control, really putting that final decision on the siting of CAFOs in the local supervisor's hand. They know their community the best. They're most responsive to community pressures because they're so much closer, as opposed to a DNR engineer down in Des Moines or up in Spencer, who may not know the local conditions. The other thing is that supervisors do like to say that they don't have a lot of power, even though they get to hear all the complaints. We encourage county supervisors to do as much as they can. And again, like I said, 26 counties, their supervisors have passed resolutions calling on the state. When it comes down to it, there are things that counties and local communities can do to help build pressure. But ultimately, that final decision does lie with the Iowa DNR. I'm the DNR director. We have a new DNR director right now who was appointed by the governor. What we've seen from the Iowa DNR is that they don't have the political will to enforce some of the laws that are in the books. So right now, our DNR is essentially functioning as a rubber stamp for this CAFO industry.
Who establishes the criteria by which the DNR has to, go through their checklist? Because basically, don't they submit a plan and then the DNR just has to see if they meet that plan? And if they do, it kind of somewhat ties their hands of whether they can or can't approve them, right?
That's right. So, yeah, that plan that a factory farm has to submit when they want to put up a new CAFO is called the Master Matrix. And this was designed back in 2002 by 12 legislators, and they convened what they called stakeholders at the time. Of course, the number of stakeholders greatly favored industrialized agriculture as opposed to independent farm groups, community groups, and environmental groups. And so what we ended up with was essentially a test that a factory farmer will fill out. This test, now picture this test, where you only have to answer half of the questions, you grade yourself, and you only have to get 50% to pass. That's essentially what this is. And once you get that 50% to pass, you can submit that to the Iowa DNR. They review it, and if it meets the letter of the law, like you pointed out, they'll go ahead and approve that permit. The DNR denies less than 2% of all factory farm permits applied for every year. So what we want to see is this permitting process, again, it's just so slanted in favor of the industry that we need a moratorium so we can go back and look at all of the programs surrounding CAFOs, from permitting to enforcement, and again, open the window, open the door, so that we can start investing in beginning farmers, independent farmers, small farmers, to get more farmers on the land, you know, more younger farmers, more women farmers, farmers of color on the land, to actually bring some life back to our rural communities.
So what are the comments the legislature and the governor are, you know, giving for reasons against the moratorium?
Yeah. So, you know, these are arguments that I'm sure we all know well that we've heard. The industrial ag industry likes to use arguments about CAFOs like, this is what modern agriculture looks like. They like to use arguments like, Iowa farmers feed the world. You know, that's the justification we have for this monoculture crop system and all of these factory farms. The reality is, you know, there's a lot of hunger in Iowa, and we have problems feeding ourselves. We have to import about 90% of the food we eat here in the state. So if we can't even feed ourselves, we should not be taking it upon ourselves to feed the world. The other thing that I hear a lot, and, you know, President Trump's Secretary of Ag, Sonny Perdue, said this at a meeting with struggling dairy farmers late last fall, is this mentality of get bigger, get out. There is a constant push in the farm community to get bigger, to keep getting bigger, or to get out. And if you don't get big, the thinking is it's your own fault. We don't believe that at CCI. You know, we know that is a system that only supports a handful of corporate ag giants, a handful of giant seed companies, chemical fertilizer companies, and meat companies like JBS out of Brazil, like Smithfield, which is now Chinese-owned, or like Prestige Foods out of North Carolina that continues to expand in north central Iowa.
Well, thank you. That's a very strong statement, and I really appreciate your coming on. Approval of the Matrix was a big issue last year in Story County, and we covered that. So I know how high the feelings were, mostly against it. So it's good to hear some of that larger background. Thanks for being with us today, Adam.
Absolutely. Thank you, Susan.
Okay. Well, we'll take a little break before we come back. We have a little music. We have a little bluegrass. And then we have something from Mike Metz.
Hey folks, we're the Monroe Crossing Bluegrass Band. We took the name Monroe Crossing to pay tribute to Bill Monroe, who's the father of bluegrass music. And we all met because of bluegrass music, so we had a Monroe Crossing.
Been sailing around the sea of life to everywhere the wind's been blowing. It's like a dull edge of always right, but never knowing. It's a mixed up world, you know it's true. Spin right around you like nothing you can do. It's easy to get lost when you don't know where you're going.
Thank you. easy mess. To be him was a trip, now it's flowing. It's a mixed up world,
you know it's true.
I'm Mike Metz. I had an opportunity recently to visit with two people involved with the Iowa Prairie Network's winter meeting. Lloyd Krim told me about how this group started and some of the topics that will be discussed at the meeting. Carmen Rosberg gave me some of the details behind the meeting and how the organization goes about raising funds that are used for conservation projects in Iowa. This morning, I'm visiting with Lloyd Krim about the Iowa Prairie Network. Lloyd, tell us what got you interested in prairies.
I've been interested in prairies most of my life, and at college, we had the opportunity to get a group together to do things on prairie, and it evolved into the Iowa Prairie Network.
Okay, so that was the early 80s?
Yeah, the real early 80s. We started doing this winter seminar, and we've been doing it for quite a number of years now, and it's grown quite a bit, so we've gotten, you know, there's over a couple hundred some people that attend.
This is a winter seminar. Where is it being held?
At the Ames High School.
Okay, and is this free and open to the public?
Yes, it is. It's free and open to the public. If we always joke that if somebody doesn't like what they're doing, they can have their money back.
Okay. They can have their money back. It's like volunteering.
Yeah.
The pay always is the same, right? So you've got quite a few volunteers, I understand. Mike Todd and his group mm-hmm. will be helping. How will they help?
They've got the students, and they run around, and they'll set up signs and stuff in the halls of the high school and help people get around. We've got a number of speakers lined up, and we've got several different aspects to it. Some of the speakers in the early morning are dealing with how to identify some of the different plants. In the afternoon, we've got other people giving talks. And this year, we're going to sort out what the different asters are. Each year, we take a different plant group and try and give you information on those.
Asters are those plants that have the multi-petals, small floral aspect, many on a plant.
Right, and they're white and they're hard to identify. They look alike to a lot of us.
So are they a composite flower, or they have many seeds and flowerettes?
Yeah, they're one of the composite members. They're difficult to identify because there's so many of them that look alike.
Thanks, Lloyd. And we'll see you there at the meeting on Saturday, January 25th at the Ames High School. I am visiting with Carmen Rosberg, who is a volunteer with the Iowa Prairie Network. Thanks for sharing some of your time, Carmen.
Thanks, Mike.
Why are you interested in prairies and the natural resources?
Well, I've always had a love for the outdoors, camping with my folks growing up, and then after I married my husband, we lived on a farm and tried to be as self-sustaining as possible.
Okay.
And that kind of led to his lifelong interest and his graduate work in prairies. Through the years, we eventually ended up on an acreage where we have our own prairies and work with people who have prairies, and we just have a great love and understanding of them.
How did you stumble on the Iowa Prairie Network?
I actually was introduced to that group by a friend of mine that I worked with, Inger Lamb, and Tom oftentimes spoke at this group, and then we became members.
Tell me a little bit about the Iowa Prairie Network.
It's a member-driven organization, statewide, divided up into regions. A particular event that we're going to talk about is for Region 5, which is Central Iowa.
Okay, so this is their winter meeting.
Their winter meeting.
All right, and can you tell me a little bit about what goes on during a winter meeting?
Well, a variety of things, workshops, special talks, and a silent auction.
How does one get involved with the silent auction?
Well, the silent auction kind of came about many, many years ago, and it was kind of a white elephant. Bring something that you don't need anymore, and those funds raised on that silent auction will go to support some type of public prairie or some organization or work to support a prairie.
Items that are contributed by folks that attend the meeting, or can it be folks outside of the group?
It certainly can. A lot of businesses, a lot of other organizations put together baskets or promotional items that they'd like to share. County conservation boards, event kind of organizations like White Rock Conservancy will give an overnight stay.
Okay.
And so it can be both. But a lot of it is membership driven. The membership will contact me and say, I have this I'd like to bring to the auction. And then I create a form and they bring it the day of the auction, the event.
The day of the event. So people can bring ahead of time or the day of the event.
Right.
For our KHOI listeners, they still have time.
Yes.
When is the winter meeting going to be held?
It's going to be held Saturday, January 25th at Ames High Prairie.
Okay.
And the event itself, the activities will start about 9:30 in the morning.
Offering for that.
Sure.
Okay.
Yep.
Can you share with our listeners some of the presenters at this year's winter meeting?
This year, we're going to have Carl Kurtz talking about 40 years of prairie reconstruction. These are the morning sessions. We'll have Deb Lewis and Tom Rosberg talking about sorting out asters, so aster identification work.
Right.
And an introduction to iNaturalist app for people who are into electronics. Later in the day, there'll be three sessions, bumblebees, biology and ecology, and a panel discussion on do's and don'ts of the prairie.
Okay.
And the third one will be a photo presentation, so kind of a feel-good, look at some pretty pictures and enjoy the conversation with Doug Haar.
Okay, you cover a lot of bases during these meetings. You also have other individuals involved. Some of the other groups have displays?
Right. We do have a room with different kinds of vendors, I guess you could call them, or organizations that support native or natural work. They come in and a lot of samples are given out, a lot of discussions are held, and a lot of information is shared.
If somebody were interested in a small city planting, maybe a couple of acres, is this a place that folks should go to for advice, for tips?
Yes, there will be very professional people who do this for their living, and there will be a lot of people there that day that have started their own or would like to start their own or want more information, and it's the perfect place to find that.
Excellent.
That starting information.
About the auction.
Right. We have a pay now and we have a silent auction. So things that might be a little more used, or maybe whoever donated it designates that they want it to just be taken by whoever can find the most value from it. We'll have several tables that are just buy it now. You just free will donation into a box, which goes into the total at the end. And then other items that are donated will be silent auction items where you write down your name and the amount you're willing to pay for that item. And then after, at the end of the event, the auction is closed, you go to the last session, we combine everything, and then you come back to find out if you got.
Okay.
If you won that item. And okay. We'll have that all ready and prepared for you. We prefer cash or check. We don't take credit cards, so it is best to bring cash or check.
Okay. What are some of the projects that you have funded in the past?
Okay, we have funded a number of different things. Everything from acquisitions by other organizations, like supporting. In 2019, we did Hargrove's Prairie Purchase, which was through the Iowa Department of Natural Resources.
So what you're doing is you're helping match funds,
right,
or combine with other groups.
Right, for important purchases or important protections. We've supported remnant prairies by helping the holder of that remnant prairie maybe bring in workers to help them do burns or cut brush or check invasives. And we have also funded students to go and work on private prairies through educational organizations, several of them.
So do you know where the funds will be going for this meeting?
The funds for this particular silent auction will be going to Wild Way Iowa Wildlife
Rehabilitators.
Yep, and they will be doing some work on Savannah Prairie. So they will probably do some clearing, some seeding, and some management practices.
Okay.
It's an organization that's also has a large outreach in Central Iowa.
Okay, Carmen, thank you for your time. And once again, where is this meeting going to be held?
It's going to be held at Ames High on September 25th from 9:30 in the morning until 5 in the afternoon. And to reach me, if you're interested in making donations or want more information, you can call me at 515-232-0048 and ask for Carmen.
Once again?
515-232-0048. And or you can contact me at Prairie Rivers of Iowa and I will help you with that.
Okay. Thank you very much. Uh-huh.
In case you just tuned in, this is KHOI Community Radio, where we just heard from the Prairie Network Winter Meeting from Mike Metz, Lloyd Krim, and Carmen Rosberg. Among other things that they talked about were invasive species. Our last guest, Chad Kletchen, has a creative idea that they came up with at Big Creek State Park near Polk City. Chad is works for the district park for he's for the DNR for South Central District, and of which Big Creek is part. And they had a lot of black locust trees that were really taking over the park a few years ago. And Chad, hello, are you there?
I am here. Good morning.
Well, thank you so much. And I had a really interesting conversation with you about how you handled that. You came up with a very creative way for dealing with that invasive species. What was it?
Yeah. So we have lots of smaller trees, you know, 6-inch diet PVH and things like that, a little smaller. So one of the things that we realized is that, you know, it'd make good log furniture. So we found ourselves a tenon and mortise tool. We started playing around with patterns and so forth like that. And by using select trees and select methods, we were able to take down these trees and just create a sort of an Adirondack or a rustic-looking chair to sit in. We actually have one or two of them out in our shelters now, and they're very comfortable. And it's just a way to put a use to something that really nobody else wants at this point. The black locust tree itself is an invasive species. You know, it was planted at one time for erosion control, and it also has some unique characteristics and properties in being somewhat naturally rot resistant. And it's a very dense and heavy wood. It should last for a very long time.
Well, I'm glad that you found a use for the wood. And being married to a former woodworker, he's retired. He didn't bring his shop with him when he left home. I know that finding a great source of wood would be really nice, although I suppose it's not too easy to get it from the park to your wood shop.
Well, like I said, it's a unique wood to work with. It's so dense, it's hard to work with, especially with the woodworking tools, things like that. So one of the things that we did was just work with it when it's green. What we've noticed is that, yeah, we do see some cracking and checking, but not what you expect, and the trails chairs are really still structurally sound. So that was one way we found a workaround for dealing with the wood characteristics itself.
Well, that's really interesting, because, of course, that's different from any other wood I know of. You usually want to wait till it's dry but and aged. So you cut it when it's green. And how do people get it?
Right now, we're working on developing the program here at Big Creek State Park, and I would encourage people, if they're interested, just to email the State Park through the State Park's webpage. You can contact the park directly. We've had some staffing transitions, so we're not only are we teaching the new guys how to do this process and the tips and tricks to get the product made, but then we'll be working on getting the ideas back out to the public as well as an educational program.
Okay, well, we'll be sure to have that on our website so that our listeners can get it if they're interested.
Are you giving workshops on this furniture making?
We will be doing some workshops. We do not have them planned as of yet, but they will be coming in the next few months.
And what was your website where people can get more information?
If you go to www.iowadnr.gov and then just find your way to Big Creek State Park under destinations.
Are there some other uses besides chairs that you're working on?
Well, you know, the basic construction premise will work for just about anything. You know, we're working with a smaller diameter wood. You could probably turn it into tables and chairs, anything, just whatever your magic can really drum up. I'm not a woodworker by trade. I'm really not very good at it, but this is something I could do. So it's a skill that almost anybody can handle. It's just learning the little tricks to putting the pieces together.
You mentioned that it was hard on tools. I know that that's certainly true for hickory. It really wears them out. So if you don't get a green, is it difficult to work with?
Yeah, it can burn up drill bits. It can burn up saw blades. And that's what we've seen in some of the past tenses. But we've had really good luck doing this.
Well, that sounds, and I think we're going to have, for those who go to our website, I think we're going to have a lovely picture that I got from your publication that shows three of these handsome chairs. That's really what pulled me into the story. I thought, oh, we want to be able to show people how neat this is.
We were just looking for some way to find a new use for it, and you know, I don't like cutting stuff down for no apparent reason, so sometimes it's fun just to have a little fun with it.
Well, this does sound like fun, and thank you so much for coming on today to tell us about it. Have a good day.
All right. Thank you.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm Susan Franzen, one of your hosts for today, together with Gina McAndrews. Other voices you heard were Ingrid Gronstahl Anderson, Adam Mason, Mike Metz, Lloyd Krim, Carmen Rosberg, and Chad Kletchen.
You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org, which includes links to today's stories.
Local Talk was engineered by Paul Hertz. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was St. Elmo's Fire from the cassette, 80s Music Experts, and Monroe Crossing by Monroe Crossing Bluegrass Band.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, please contact us at 515-292-2878. That's 515-292-2878. Or contact us through our website at khoifm.org. That's also what you need to know to contact us if you decide to become a member. Or you can renew your membership any day, including today, so just look for that donate button.
If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and
see you again on the radio. Thank you.